This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm going to tell you how that person with the big medal and the fancy costume got to that place there, okay? I come from, you know, a fairly normal place on Long Island, as we would say, Long Island in New York. And, you know, you just never know where someone is going to pop up from. You know, it can start anywhere. And so I'll tell you about my childhood, actually. So I'm going to begin with a little preface. The foundation has asked to talk, the Inomori Foundation, Kyoto Prize, has asked me to talk about my life as a young person and how I think I was formed. And I've actually never really discussed this, so I'm actually kind of happy and excited to share this with everybody. I don't know how, I see how excited and happy you are at the end, but so a significant portion of the life and work of William Forsythe is now the subject of extensive public record, and it's perhaps in this context not in need of elaboration or repetition, as it was suggested you can go online and find out, right? But what I can provide today is a more intimate perspective on William Forsythe's early career and life that is actually not part of any public record. So you have the, you know, the inside story here. Billy Forsythe is how William Forsythe was called until the beginning of his 40s. There's some people in the room who know me as Billy, so, but really, yeah. It's necessary to note Billy's formative experiences in order to perform some kind of triangulation in understanding the later appearing Bill Forsythe, who's also the father of some children, and the public-facing William Forsythe. So William Forsythe is the name on the front of the shop, right? It's what people on the street see. So all three, Billy, Bill, and William, have choreographed, and most importantly, though, they are self-taught, as choreography, especially ballet choreography, is an autodidactic field, which means a field where you teach yourself, yeah? It's exclusively autodidactic. At present, not one of the highly visible choreographers who are fully versed in the structural intricacies of classical ballet is the product of an educational program. Not one, okay? To my knowledge, there is at present not a single conservatory, college, or other such institution which offers a comprehensive program of specialization in the subject of professional ballet choreography. Now, compare this to every other field of expertise in the arts and sciences that is open to public critique and analysis, and you have a rather shocking anomaly. No schools, no teachers. Can you imagine? How do you get there? You know, it's like, it's crazy. Yeah. All right. So given this rather odd professional precondition, what did comprise my training? Yeah. So we need to go back 70 years. So it's 1955. So do the math. I'm 75, right? And my earliest memory of dancing was, of course, for my parents around the age of 5, right? And to their delight, I would pretend I was Fred Astaire. Do you know who Fred Astaire is, young people? You have any idea? He was a movie star. Okay, he was an exceptionally good tap dancer. And he would hold this, he would be partnered with this lady named Ginger Rogers. And so I would have an imaginary Ginger Rogers, and I would pretend I was Fred Astaire. And I would put on these very enthusiastic performances for my parents and their friends, right? Unbeknownst to Fred Astaire and his brilliant choreographic colleagues, which they truly were, he was my very first model of danced excellence. This was some seriously good dancing, yeah. He and his choreographer colleagues were my very first teachers. This is what I thought good dancing was, yeah. So, and another early example of my enthusiasm involved smelling every and any flower that came my way, okay? I'm little. It also involved talking to those flowers, and as you might suspect, on occasion, since the title of the thing is Sometimes I Kiss Flowers, I would kiss them. Yeah. I might still occasionally kiss flowers. Yeah. They're like children, you know. As a child, nature did not feel separate. And this connection was encouraged by my mother, who always shared her own fascination with flowers and nature. And as soon as I had the dexterity, she taught me to actually arrange flowers for the household. Now, these arrangements were, I believe, my very first conscious foray into the domain of aesthetics. Yeah, you have a composition there. I'm like, okay. I am still fascinated by floral composition and admire the great practitioners, yeah, especially the practitioners of Ikebana in Japan. I applied to be an exchange student to study Ikebana, but I didn't qualify for the program. But I still practice on my own in a very amateur way, and it's very enjoyable, right? Somewhat in alignment with that, I was eventually given the role of the person who was to decorate the family Christmas tree. Has anyone ever had that privilege? Oh, see, there you go. You feel me, right? And it's quite an honor, and I couldn't have been happier being given the opportunity to independently compose an aesthetics of explosive, luminant proliferation. And this particular decorative task, though, induced a state of intense focus, which I alleviated periodically by lying under the tree. Okay, now in and under the tree, the arrangements of the lights and the shiny ornaments radically altered my perception of the task, right? So I would alternate standing in front of the tree and then lying under the tree to compose the results I was aiming for. This compositional strategy unquestionably prefigured some of my unusual choreographic procedures applied later in my career. I've been regarded as something called a post-classicist. I'm not quite sure what they mean, but I would rather like to offer the term endoclassicist, someone who analyzes and assembles from within the sensation of ballet's immense array of anatomical articulations, not observing and, you know, assembling from exclusively from the outside, but dialoguing with interior sensation and exterior positions, inside out, as it were. There's a film, right, everyone loves, called Inside Out, I think, yeah. So it has a lot of choreography in it too. I love those Pixar things. They're totally choreographic, yeah. So I guess the trajectory in this case of an art form had been somewhat influenced by a tree. Okay, thank you, tree. My father, who had a flawless instinct for humor based on wordplay, was also someone very aware of the aesthetics of his surroundings. In fact, I think of him as a kind of visual connoisseur. So with very loving discernment, he gathered antique examples of arts and crafts, furniture and stuff, and conveyed to me what he knew about these historical examples of elevated craftsmanship. And I think the fact that not art, but craft, you know, stuff, was more revered in our household is an important detail in my development. I guess he taught me to appreciate how things are made and what they're made of. Importantly, my father explained to me the details of why he liked the things he did, on what grounds his preferences were based, which is a key distinction one must make when communicating with adult artists in the rehearsal studio. In other words, communicating why you think a particular move, let's say, should go a particular way, yeah? Rather than say, go faster. That's so unproductive, right? And going like, yeah. So thank you, Dad, right? So my father's profession was somehow similar to mine insofar as he worked with a team of artists, yeah? Visual artists who produced drawings for his Manhattan-based advertising agency, which dealt exclusively in illustrations for print advertisements. And he would sometimes take me along on studio visits where I could see the artist focus on their non-commercial work for him. And usually there were oil painters, right? And they would let me observe them while they painted, and they explained to me what they were attempting to paint, right? Now, as a child, I just happened to notice that little difference, attempt. So they weren't saying, I will do this. Yeah, it was not clear. Yeah, and although they seemed impossibly skilled from my perspective, they allowed uncertainty, yeah, a place in their practice and craft. And I think that's super important. Yeah, super important. Interesting, interesting teachers, parent mentors. Yeah. My mother shared my father's sensibilities, and I might add, she always smelled like a bouquet of flowers. It was fantastic. Yeah. I was just like in awe of her. Yeah, she was cool. And she taught me to identify where some of those perfumes originated in the garden. I believe my parents were people who deeply appreciated the world that our senses offer us. Yeah. Apropos, by the age of six, and apropos California, my mother had taught me to body surf in the ocean by the time I was six. I never had a boogie board, anything. It was just body surfing. Yeah. And I think this is a practice with an immensely valuable lesson to teach me, which is to work with what nature was offering you and to partner and adapt, right? That's surfing, I think, yeah. And this approach, this is an approach that guides me through the unpredictable dynamics of a creation process, right? You better adapt or you're sunk because things will change, yeah. So I would say that the ocean has composed some of the most vivid physical dialogues I have ever experienced, as in waves that really took me for a ride, right? And had I not sufficiently partnered and adapted with some particular waves, I might not have been able to be here to share this with you. Yeah. To me, the ocean feels like an organism that seems to understand the nature of breath and, by extension, the nature of death. Yeah. And it effortlessly reminds you of this impressive fact. Teachers are perhaps within everything. Don't expect your teachers, you young people, to be teachers. Yeah. Life's going to be your best teacher. Yeah. Every kind of thing is going to teach you if you are willing to let it teach you. Yeah. Keep your eyes open. The world is teaching you. Yeah. Everything. Yeah, you want, yeah, is there. You just have to not make an assumption, yeah, like you're assuming a teacher is something exterior, yeah. You must teach yourself how to live, right, your life. And the same applies to anything you wish to accomplish, okay? So, my teenage years, like your teenage years, were spent in nonstop motion. I can't tell you how many times at school I was asked to sit still. I actually started to choreograph in 1963 at the age of 13. That's 62 years ago. And included all these high school musicals and skits. And I sang in several choirs and vocal ensembles. And I played several instruments. And I designed all the high school dances, among other things. I was a human tornado, yeah. But a fundamentally creative tornado. And I really, really, really wanted to learn to tap dance, right? My parents, unsurprisingly, sent me to ballroom dancing classes instead. That was, yeah. Okay, so my father's mother was a violin prodigy, right? He was Austrian, and he was my violin teacher. And he announced to me one day that the career in classical music that he was preparing me for was not gonna happen. Okay. And in his very strong Austrian accent, he offered the comment, Willy, you will never be a great violinist, yeah? Yeah, but you'll be a very good conductor. So, yeah. Thank you, Grandpa. So in addition to teaching me the rudiments of conducting, right, he then proceeded to carefully take me through his extraordinary record collection. Yeah, it was amazing. But he pointed out all the nuances between the different conductors and the instrumentalist interpretations. And this proved to be another introduction to the possibility of artistic differentiation, right? Not so dissimilar to the way my father had illuminated the nuances in his field of artisanal interest, right? It was a family of teachers Who knew, right? Incidentally, I once choreographed a work which functions as an orchestra, but an orchestra that's only composed of conductors. Put that into your, So aside from endless dancing and popular styles in high school, I also spent many afternoons by myself in my family's kitchen dancing to Broadway musicals that were broadcast on the radio. And my partners at this time were no longer imaginary Ginger Rogers, but rather all the handles on the kitchen appliances and drawers and stuff, right? And with terrifying velocity, I would launch myself into bizarre pas de deux between the appliances, as only a teenager can, right? So perhaps unsurprisingly, though, the dynamic, similar to the push-pull mechanics of these kitchen duets, was later introduced to as a unique component of the partnering work that would appear in the ballets, like In the Middle, Somewhat Elevated. Yeah, so who would have thought that kitchen appliances could have influenced the conventions of an art form? You see, you just don't know. So, now, given that I could sing and, of course, dance, I had the idea that I would somehow go to Broadway, right? I had absolutely no formal training whatsoever. But nonetheless, I took myself to open auditions in New York City, which is only a short subway ride away, right? So in one memorable audition, the choreographer demonstrated something and I expressed tremendous delight. I was like, whoa, what was that? And now the group of rather weary professional dancers in the room laughed because they thought I was being ironic, right? They thought I was joking. And I said, no, what was that? It was really cool. To which the choreographer replied, young man, that was a pirouette. Yeah. I was, of course, immediately sent out of the audition, right? So I had no idea how one could learn this very cool move, a pirouette. So instead, I threw myself into club dancing. I had like a fake ID. I'll get, you know what I mean? I got in. And but these were the very first iterations of what were called discos. Yeah. At the disco, doesn't that sound so 80s? But this is like the 60s, right? Yeah. And I'll be, so at the disco, I persevered in a very ferocious competitive dance environment, right? Until I was actually allowed to dance, albeit briefly, solo on the raised central podium. This intimidating experience of in public appraisal actually helpfully modeled the future realities of offering invention for public scrutiny. We all know how lethal we can be in high school in criticizing each other's dancing, right? Like, be honest, right? Yeah, come on, yeah. So now we'll jump back 10 years, okay? We're jumping all over it. This is, that was the late 60s, and this is back in 1957, and my father had begun to very subtly retract into the recesses of Parkinson's disease. It's not a good disease. When I was 7 years old. Only 12 years later was this fully apparent, as a diagnosis for early onset Parkinson's was not available in 1957. And my father, sensing that something was deeply wrong, sought help in a religious approach to healing, as his physicians had only offered tranquilizers to address his symptoms, which is shaking. Yeah. So his particular, or the religious approach that he adopted, did not believe in the efficacy of doctors, or actually in the reality of bodily disease, or the reality of the body. Okay. Or in fact, according to the doctrine, all conceptions of reality that posited it as real were fundamentally erroneous. They were wrong. Okay. Now, although in some contexts some of these arguments might be legitimately debated, they are not necessarily subjects for seven-year-olds. Okay, just I think it's a bit much, it overloads them. But the confrontation with these concepts provided me with my first introduction to a philosophical provocation. Like, what do you mean I'm not real, right? I was like, I'm real. So the shock of this challenge to my existence introduced a novel mode of mentality, which required a different kind of agility, mental agility in mental space. So this moment is key to understanding Bill, who, when he appears later in life, was already deeply enamored of the sensation of thought challenges, right? So Billy had, though, through this serendipitous encounter with an outlier belief system, had been trained to be a conceptual acrobat, right? It turned out that Billy could mentally move not only concepts, but images, objects, bodies, whatever turned out to be useful, right? So, I mean, that's good for a choreographer, I think. You know, it's helpful. So Billy had by chance been sent to mental acrobatics class, right? Fantastic. As a side note, I still think tap classes might have been adequate. Yeah. Oh, you want to do a little mental juggling?
Sure.
Would you like to do it? Okay. You can do it sitting. Okay. So we're going to do a pattern, X pattern. You going to do it with me?
Yeah.
Don't be shy. You will not be judged. Okay. Okay, you're going to go tap one knee, and you're going to go, yeah, and you're going to tap the other knee, tap, tap. Shoulder, shoulder, right? So one, two, three, four. Now you're going to say red, yellow, blue, green. Let's do it again. Red, yellow, blue, green. Red, yellow, blue, green. Now we're going to rotate it one position this way. So we're going to go yellow, green, red, blue. Continue. Some of you have the talent. Some of you have the capacity. Yeah. So you can do this. I developed this into actually a very complex thing that I believe is for people with special abilities, people who have the capacity to, there are some people like myself who have the capacity to move objects in space. And it is a work which you can acquire, yeah, if you can perform it without any problems. Yeah. So if you can do this without any help, you own the piece. Okay. Yeah. You can't sell it for money though. Okay. Because you got it for free, so you have to give it for free. Okay. So at home, there was lots of literature on the shelves, classics, translation, plays, a lot of poetry from different cultures. And as an American kid of that epoch, there was an endless stream of comic books. I mean, I think I'm one of the first generations of comic book readers, right? And magazines full of propaganda. It was in the 50s, yeah, post-war. New York was about to be bombed, you know, nuclear holocaust was just around the corner. And newspapers, literature became my strongest subject in school. I really loved it. My great uncle Cornelius had been shell-shocked in the First World War and had spent the rest of his life only reading the dictionary. And this fascinated me, yeah. And I tried to emulate him, but I chose rather not to be a copycat. I chose Roget's Thesaurus, which I think really, really did help me at school, just doing that, yeah. And I still enjoy reading, and I love that thing. Do any of you use Word, you know, Microsoft Word? They had that thing, the dictionary on the side, and you do the thesaurus. I'm addicted to that. I love that. Yeah, very helpful. Anyway, my reading expanded into philosophy, and at the end of the 20s, I began to read philosophy at the end of my 20s, and I ended up sort of landing on Alfred North Whitehead, Ilya Prigogine, Isabel Stengers, John Dewey, and the writing of these thinkers provided invaluable templates for approaching practice. Meanwhile, back in the 50s, the black and white television, a relatively new invention at the time, can you imagine, had provided a window into the world of live broadcast, entertainment, classic movie musicals, cartoons. Oh, does anyone know Fantasia? Oh, you do? Isn't that awesome? Yeah, I know. And that was my first introduction to the principles of classical ballet choreography. I didn't even know what ballet was, you know. So I was being exposed to ballet without even knowing it. And that is a really brilliant, brilliant work. And so on TV, there were also surprisingly art films. Yeah. And it was the film La Jetée by Chris Marker, which I encountered in 1963 at the age of 13. And this film preoccupied me for roughly half a century. Yeah, it functioned as a paradigm or an example of fugally arranged visual narration, if you can imagine that. It really profoundly influenced my approach to choreographic structuring. The filmmaker Alain René also contributed a similar trove of possibilities, and his film Providence exerted tremendous influence upon my work. So now we're going to skip again. 1967, I'm 17 years old. I'm being shipped off to university to study business, but instead deviously studying theater and art history. I did not tell my parents. Okay? you can't imagine. So we'll skip all the details, and we'll skip the details of following my roommate to ballet class one day, right? And realizing, oh yeah, I could finally learn that cool move called pirouette, you know? And I could learn it from my really committed teacher, Crystal Long, who mentored me with an unparalleled loving ferocity. My first actual dance teacher, like, yay. She was German, yeah, who one day declared in a strong German accent, yeah, Billy, you are a dancer, but you are actually a choreographer, yeah? It's like the Austrian accent, actually. Yeah, so, and I really did not understand what she meant, because I had been choreographing, as I mentioned, for several years, but I never thought of it as choreography from a formal perspective, right? You were just making dances for fun, right? So Krista, my teacher, commissioned me at 18 to make my first official public work, and it apparently resonated quite well with audience and critics. So all my previous coincidental lessons, surfing included, yeah, had somehow given me enough information to pass my first official public choreographic examination. So in this business, you're thrown into the deep end of the pool. That's it. And swim, you know. And apparently I did not drown, so here I am to, you know, tell you the tale, right? So at this moment, several ideas have taken hold. The mathiness of ballet, as my friend Teresa Ruth Howard likes to phrase it, unleashed a veritable mindstorm of recombinative possibilities. Music now became a medium for imagining logical progressions of coordinations within a precisely defined environment of consistent rules. Ballet's kinetic puzzles and the movement strategies to solve their physics were my new teachers, right? Like the ocean wave. They allowed me to teach myself, but on their own terms, right? So the bodily dialogues with ballet, like those with the ocean waves, were protracted and intense and requiring a physical and mental engagement of an entirely new order. It was no joke, yeah? Ballet, not unlike the philosophical challenge presented to my 7-year-old self, kept reasserting its non-existence. The idea of it, which comes before the act, was a conceptualized strategy that proposed ballet, but only in theory. The enactments, these approximations of a collectively held prescription, were at the beginning utterly unsustainable. And even also later on in your career, they become utterly unsustainable, right? Ballet frequently obstructed in my body, yes, its own manifestation. Yeah, behaving like a particularly unpredictable ocean wave. Ballet, it turns out, is impossible to sustain. Okay, so am I being balletic right now? Probably not, right? Am I balletic now? Yes, I am, right? But I cannot sustain this. I could not sustain this, right? I could do this for a while. You know, you could watch me struggle, yeah. But it is a process that you introduce to people. You go through it, yeah, it's a state, and I'll tell you all about it. Okay, ballet, it's impossible to sustain, and there is also no moment of synchronic kinetic unity, yeah? Like an object that could be described in all its simultaneous and constituent facets. There's no universally standardized description of reference as exists in the sciences, right? It's not like becoming a lawyer, for example, yeah? Also, so ballet isn't to be accurately or comprehensively described at the level of its enactment in its required aggregate of simultaneously different velocities of limbs, rotations, accelerations, vectors, centrifugal forces, ballistics, yeah? But the convergence of these competing forces offers the participant a kind of unique opportunity to navigate an intense environment of perceptual facts, let's say, yeah? The work of a ballet dancer is to harness the perceptual chaos intrinsically proposed by a choreography. I'm going to say that again. The work of a ballet dancer is to harness the perceptual chaos intrinsically proposed by a choreography. In other words, choreography sort of puts you out there to fail. That's what we like about ballet, is it? Yeah, that it can fail. That's what we like about sports, right? He's going for it. Yeah. Oh, you know. That makes a game interesting, right? Same thing with ballet. I'm turning. Oh, I'm not turning. You can't fake a failed pirouette. Sorry, you can't fake a failed. I'm not American. What do you call it when you catch the football?
A catch.
A catch? I don't know. How technical. I thought a receiver. A reception, right? So it turns out that ballet dancing's complex accumulation was primarily composed of interwoven, torqued, and rotated folding patterns, right? That's it. It's torqued and rotating folding patterns, which at the level of professional expression manifest as a specific state of being balletic, not doing ballet. Or ballet, being balletic. So when I went out there, I went into the thing. Yeah. You know, okay. Now I'm not balletic. I am being balletic, right? And it's a state. It's a state you call up, right? So takes a few years. It's an emergent property where the behavior of the whole system can't be easily predicted or explained just by understanding its parts. Yeah, the dancer must aggregate, synthesize, and then simultaneously prioritize multiple specific proprioceptive inputs. Proprioception is what tells you, the faculty that tells you where you are in space and how you are. Like, I know how my fingers are if I close my eyes and I know where they are. That's called proprioception. Okay. So understanding this is important because without this finely tuned, finely differentiated proprioceptive awareness, a career in dance is basically just learning differences. Differences between this, this, that, blah, blah, and being to call these differences up at any given time, yeah, while you're in the middle of a flow, yeah. And there, all these differences are actually the subject because they relate to certain epochs of history. At one point, you know, this was very important. Another point, that was this. This is another class of dancing. This is seldom used in ballet, the flat hand or the unbeveled hand and so on and so forth. So you speak of history. Anytime you engage in the balletic state, you are an historical document to some degree, yeah? So ballet is a fine-tuned sensitivity to minute difference, incredibly fine differences. It's a specific proprioceptive state aligned with specific spatial intention. Okay, does that make sense? The dancers are going to do that. Yeah, okay, good. So in order to secure a diminishing percentage of less specific pirouettes, I left university with a scholarship to a major ballet company in New York City. It's now 1969, and I, Billy, am now 19 years old and have been studying ballet for only a year and a half, right? It was terrifying, yeah. So ballet's impression upon me was profound, and to move to the center of North American ballet in New York City during the tenure of choreographer George Balanchine at the New York City Ballet was an extraordinary opportunity. It's an understatement. Our entire global profession have been impacted by Balanchine's genius and by his dancers who express his ideas with astounding clarity of vision. So my first teachers, some who had worked directly with Balanchine, restricted adherence to his revolutionary innovations. And according to my teacher, teachers, there was actually no other model to study or emulate. And after witnessing the New York City Ballet's performances between 1969 and 1973, I could not have agreed more. Balanchine's work still remains for me the epitome of craft in our particular métier. Yeah. The vocabulary of Balanchine's work was firmly grounded in the simplicity of the academy, which I spoke about before, the rule part, yeah? But his structural choices, determined by his musicological expertise, were confounding, right? So Balanchine's neoclassical work was a question of technical principles shorn of all stylistic accretions, yeah, thereby implying that all the anachronistic theatrical and aesthetic tropes that are strongly associated with classical repertory. So what do you ballet, you say, hi, ballet, and you go like, pink tutu. I'm like, I hate you, you know? Because a ballet is what you do. Yeah, it's not what you put it in. Yeah, it's not the scenery. It's not even the music, yeah? It is a human activity, yeah? And it has become associated with popular taste of particular epochs, particularly the 19th century, yeah? And so we live with that. I don't particularly like it, but Balanchine was a great inspiration, yeah? So I found a model which illustrated that it is creatively, yeah, acceptable, perhaps even preferable, to abandon previous determining standards, the pink tutus, the chandeliers, et cetera, et cetera. I was free to choose. It said to me that ballet choreographies are inventions that wrangle with the historical continuity of their very own innovation. So tutus weren't always around, right? That was an innovation at a certain point. And just because they introduce themselves doesn't mean they have to stay at the party, you know what I mean? This is what Balanchine seemed to be showing. He used tutus very well, by the way. One feature, though, remains persistent, and that is pattern, yeah? So the composing of academically grounded ballet choreography, maybe I should be part of a choreography department now, right? is accomplished through the positioning of differences, right? The processing of pattern change is something that is fundamental to our human cognition. And all choreographic structures, yeah, like all choreographic structures acknowledge that they dialogue with that human faculty, the processing of pattern change. Okay, I'll give you an example. I'm a tutter, right? You know what tutters are? Who knows what tutters? People can move their fingers and do, you know, all that stuff. No, I'm not. I'm faking, right? So I'm going to move my fingers like this. It took me 4 years to get this combination, right? Okay, you're really impressed. I'm going to do this for 15 minutes. You're going to just go, you're going to be so bored, right? Why are you bored? Because the information is staying at the same rate, right? Yeah, and you go like, oh, wow, your brain goes complicated finger movement. Wow, very complicated. And true, it's very complicated. Admirable, boom, 1 point, yeah? But at one point, to save energy, your brain's going, no new information's coming out. So complexity in itself is not a lot of information if protracted, right? So if, though, I go, whoop, like that, out of this, what happens? Your fine minds go, anomaly or trend? Yeah? So I go back, and then I go, oh, it was a trend. Va-da-da. Okay, interesting, like that. And then, it's becoming a leading thematic. You know, it's like you write a book, you know what I mean? But this is abstract narrative, yeah? And so you go, oh, okay, these are the things that happen with that one thing. And I go, wow, oh, okay, anomaly or trend, yeah? So we're going, bum, bum, da-da-da-da-da. And that's how you build structure, okay? But you can't go ba-ah-bee-ba-da-da-da-da-da from the beginning unless you're saying that's a theme, but then it becomes less interesting when it's introduced, right? So you have to basically, I have it all here in the lecture, hold on. So the composing, So the choreographic craft of ballet involves contrasting pattern expectation with pattern novelty. Right, with surprise, so that the spectator becomes an active acknowledged partner in the stream of events. Yeah, sustaining the audience's cognitive investment is finally a question of proportion, of structural rhythm. Yeah. Okay. So what are we constructing patterns with? I think I'm going to jump because of the time. Okay. Here we go. It's 1971, and I require knee surgery, and it's going to take. I decided to take a course in dance notation in the 1920s. Rudolf von Laban, a dance and movement theoretician, developed a notation system called Laban notation. It's a method of recording human movement through a system of symbols. It was fascinating to learn, but an encounter with Laban's abstract system of spatial movement assignments called space harmony was life-altering. So the very curious 21-year-old Billy proceeded to investigate if there was any degree of compatibility between the two systems he had studied, Laban and classical ballet. Well, Laban's ideas, if applied to classical processes, produced some surprising displacements and sequences, which seemed to upend some of the configurative traditions of ballet practice. These configurations did not disassemble ballet, but simply revealed where historically received notions of assemblage were precisely that, historical habit, right? So, ballet, like Laban, was interested at the beginning in, was thought of as a spiritual practice, actually. They were trying to get a shortcut to God. They were thinking by using certain principles adapted from classical Greek thought that through the movements, there would be some way to connect with universal harmony, meaning AKA God, right? And it was promoted by the church, which usually is not so body friendly, right? So it was a kind of odd moment, which is very much at the beginning. But anyway, I wasn't interested in that facet, but rather in the fact of matter, how the body registered the processing of these complex configurations that ballet has, yeah? The wave of information that the sensations of those configurations produced allowed a new feeling of knowing, okay? So in our métier, in ballet, knowing feels like something, yeah? You know something because you know what it feels like. So ballet ultimately cannot look like anything for the ballet dancer on stage, yeah? But rather the complex relationships of forms that they present are deeply imprinted, memorized sensations, yeah? Does that make sense? You learn what looking like something feels like. And so, you know the thing when they stick their legs out, it's called arabesque, yeah? For example, something like that. That is a sensation. It is not a visual idea, actually. It is, and they know what arabesque is. So knowing is sensing, feeling. Yeah, so it's a nice place to be. Yeah. Okay. So ballet choreography is a series of events governed by a set of physical values, all changing at different and variable rates. And when sustained engagement with such a compound differential framework is undertaken, the experience can imply to the dancer the possibility, like I mentioned, of encountering a unique brand of knowledge, and that might have eluded other kinds of experience. So dancing is not like, let's say, reading in the same way. There has similarities, actually, but it is a different kind of experience. Reading, you can acquire knowledge in a different manner, right? And so this was the founding strategy of ballet's 16th century originators, and it survives in vestigial form. Okay, I finally encountered this like 85-year-old teacher in New York, and her name was Madame Boskovic, and she was from Serbia, right? And she would come into class like this. She was about this big. She'd come into class, she'd go, lift your leg, and like that. And she had this amazing, now, person my age, who was her proxy, who knew all the ideas of Madame Boscovich, and her name was Camille, and she demonstrated these ideas. And what it was that Madame Boscovich had figured out, this counter-torqued épaulement is what, you ever see dancers do this, but ballet dancers, they do this thing like that. That's the high-end skill, which is adjusting your head to the angle of your hand, hip, foot, yeah. And so she had figured out a way that this all evolved in reverse. It counter-torqued against itself backwards. It was amazing. And so anyone who says, I really like Forsyth, you really like Madame Boscovich, actually. And I mean that very sincerely. I owe so much to this person, yeah? And she's unacknowledged. She's invisible in the history of dance, and I'd like to make her visible because I think she's extraordinary. Yeah, I think she's just worth it all. Yeah. So, and of course, who I really need to thank are all the people who make my ideas visible, who are the dancers, right? The dancers make ideas visible, yeah. And I'm unbelievably grateful to generation, you can imagine at this age, many generations of dancers, thousands perhaps, yeah. Thousands, yeah. Who have actually stood in for Billy, Bill, and William, yeah. And to those people, I am just eternally grateful. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hi, I know that we have folks here with some questions. I'm just going to get us started. And where is the person who's giving me time? Hi. Okay, great. They asked me, may I say Bill?
Yeah, whatever you like.
Okay,
yeah.
They asked me, Bill, to give you a softball question, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask
because
you.
I sound American, but I've spent most of my life in Europe, so what is a softball question?
Yeah, it's something kind of easy to kick things off. Yeah. I'm not going to do that.
No.
I'm going to ask you, apropos of your speech last night, what in your mind is the role of the artist in complex times?
Apropos the question, I'm going to say keep the don't know mind. Yeah. I think it's important that the artist exhibit a kind of agility. Yeah, I'll say in my case, yeah. Things are moving very fast. And I think it's very important to curate mental agility when things are moving so fast right now, yeah. And that don't insist on a position. Don't insist, yeah. Just stay mobile, yeah. Active, be ready, yeah. Prepare yourself to act. But I think that you could be inclined to miss the moment for action if you are, how do you say, braced, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also, I forgot to say, awesome, right? Awesome. Mr. William Forsythe.
This is when you wish your parents were here, when your parents were alive. You know, people go, yay.
Yay. But I see a question right over here.
Hello, William. My name is Sebastian Valdez. I am from Tijuana. I am also a dancer and a choreographer, but not nearly as talented and as successful as you.
I'm just older.
I'm really interested in learning what is your choreography process and how would you describe your dance style?
Okay, so I spent my whole career trying to to investigate the method of inventing methods. Okay? So I never insisted. And I always looked, like I mentioned with the waves, yeah? What was the reality in the room? Who are the people I'm working with? It's their work as much as mine in some ways, yeah? that we used to joke in the studio, the dancers would go, "That's mine." You know, "No, no, that's mine," you know, whatever. But I think that style emerges from community. Yeah. I work differently with every single community, and by that I mean dance ensemble. Yeah. Because each one is composed differently. They're like villages, you know, or families. Yeah. And you have to not go in, for my case, I don't go in with a hard idea. I just try to figure out what do they need to love? Yeah. What do they need to love right now? And if you can identify that, or at least make that your goal, yeah, what would bring us all to a place where we all appreciate something? I think that, you know, you might end up having a fulfilling experience, you know, you and the people you work with. Is that helpful? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's all about love. It's all about love. It's fun. Yeah.
I see another question over here.
Hello. Hi. I absolutely admired your vocabulary and your use of words. I annotated so many phrases that I absolutely adored. And I was wondering, you mentioned you love literature, right? It was one of your favorite subjects. It's also one of mine. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could mention, you could recommend some authors that shaped and molded your perception of life and how it became your greatest teacher.
Okay. I'm not going to give anyone particular, because, you know, your reading habits change, right? So I was in an AP course in high school, so we had to read Anna Karenina in a week, you know, okay, and math, and, you know. But I started with classics, of course, as one does often in high school, and then later on moved, yeah, Nouvelle Vague, for example, Alain Robbe-Grillet. Very important. Kathy Acker, very important. Jeanette Winterson, Anne Carson, Borges. It's a long list. Just keep reading. I don't know about you, but I have a Kindle. You know, if I must travel, then I have a Kindle. You know, and I think I read. There's, for example, Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead. I read Whitehead because I can't. It's so complex. It's so difficult. It's so dense that it's like going to the gym. You know what I mean? It literally is. And there's such erudition there that just the experience of that person's erudition is like, it's like going to the Grand Canyon. You know, it's like, oh, wow. You know, a different scale of thought and capacity. So I think that in order to keep your mind, you know, fresh, you also need to change up exercises too. And so read things that are too hard for you. Yeah, I mean, seriously, see what happens. And you're welcome.
We've got one question over here.
Hi, I'm Danny. I'm from San Diego. I've also been involved in the arts, been doing theater for the last 13 years, and I speak on behalf of Eastlake High School. We had a question. Out of all the different dance styles, what drew you to ballet? Like, what made that click for you?
The mathiness of it. It's like problem solving. It really is problem solving. For example, when a dancer is given a choreography, it's a problem to solve. You know, like, how do I stay on my feet? How do I not fall over? How do I do these really hard things in the amount of time given? And there's this, a number of, like, how can I say it? I'm going to call them rules, but things are supposed to be done a certain way, right? And to wrangle your own body into this state, you know, where these things are automated, come like that, in this particular way, that is a serious amount of cognitive investment. Dancers are smart. Dancers are smart people. I mean, that's been my experience, and I've been around a lot. Yeah, they're smart people. And so in this environment, I think everyone is, you know, working on similar problems. It's like having a big lab at a university. Yeah, everyone's working on similar problems. Yeah. And I think people have a tremendous amount of empathy for the difficulties of it. Yeah. So I would say that its problematic nature is one of its most interesting parts. Yeah. So,
thank you so much.
You're welcome. We all want to talk much more to Mr. William Forsythe, but we are at time, unfortunately. So let's give him a big hand.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
And keep in mind dexterity of body and mind. And with that, we're off.
Okay. Off we go.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.